mean, obviously, a thing like this, the way we'll sell it is that we'll get people to lend them, borrow them, and then they won't be able to return them. it's like giving a free shot of cocaine or something like that.
Free for 6 months and give it back if you can.
Yeah. Very addictive. Yeah.
Well, we should maybe try. Try and get going. Are we ready to go? All right. This is an oral history interview with Dr. Eugene Garfield in Philadelphia on 16 November 1987. I'm Arnold Thackray, and with me is Jeffrey Sturcio. Gene, can you begin by talking a little bit about your family background and very early years?
I don't remember what, if anything, we said about all this before.
We're now taking it down for real.
Oh, you mean previous conversation?
We're going right way through.
That's
all here in note form to send us down the track.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, I was born in the Bronx. My mother and father were children of immigrants, but they were both born in New York, in Manhattan, Lower East Side. And I was the second child. My mother was married at the age of 15. And by the time I was born, she was 18 when I was born. By that time, however, my mother was no longer even living with my father. So he left her when she was pregnant, matter of fact.
Your mother's and father's names were?
Oh, my mother was Edith. Wolf was her maiden name, and my father's name was Henry Garfinkel. So, with K-L-E. And so I did not live with my, I lived with my mother alone. She worked in various jobs. I was placed in a, in fact, I was the first child in the, what's called the First Ladies Jewish Nursery in the Bronx in 1925. On Fulton Avenue, not far from Cortona Park, which still stands, the park there. And somebody actually sent me a photograph of the street that I lived on not too long ago, and it's unbelievable to see some of the changes. But basically, the structure of it, because it was a tenement that has still survived. Most of those tenement buildings are still there. Apparently across the street the projects have come in, but I can remember this. Even though I stayed there only till about the age of 4 or 5, I can remember that neighborhood as vividly as yesterday. And my mother worked during the day. She came home after we went to the nursery, and then this went on for, she got a little bit of help from her brother, who was still, I guess, not yet budding, clothing manufacturer. He was only a few years older than she was at the time. But we lived there until about 5 or 6, 7. Then later on, we moved, with the encouragement of my uncle, I think we moved to one of the West Bronx, which was, you know, a vastly improved neighborhood. It was like, you know, going from, I don't know what you call it today. Because I don't think the ghetto was, the tenements or slums were anything like they are today. I mean, somehow it doesn't seem that way anyhow. And maybe so many people live that way. But we went to a more modern neighborhood in the West Bronx that was called High Bridge. And Incidentally, I went to the public school, and I was told that although I went to public school number 2, that originally it was the number 1. Was the, I don't know whether that means public school number 1 in the Bronx or in the city or what, but and then when I moved to the other side, I went to a school called Public School 11, number 11, and it was located there. We always walked to school. It was located about 3 or 4 blocks from where I lived, and we lived on a street in the West Bronx called Woody Crest Avenue. And I've written about this somewhere, but right on the same street was a branch of the New York Public Library, and I think it was called the Woody Crest branch. I'm not sure. It was at the where Woody Crest and Shakespeare Avenue came together at a kind of an angle, and that was very significant in my life because I used to spend a lot of time in that library. It was kind of like a haven. I grew up poor. We were to try and make earn money doing a lot of jobs. Not unusual to. My mother got very angry when she found out once I worked for a quarter for a whole day in a laundry, helping run a press, a mangling, mangle, what do they call it? And I delivered orders, grocery stores, and things like that. I don't know what sort of things you're interested in hearing about in that age, I was very much under the influence of my mother's brothers. She had 5 of them. And the youngest was only 6 years older than I am. In fact, he visited me here just about a month ago. First time he'd ever been here. And on the other hand, let's say her oldest brother was kind of the father figure in the family, although my grandfather was alive. And I had very little contact with my father. The first time I saw him was when I was 5 years old. And although I had visited his mother when I was a few years old, and I remember being very frightened at that experience. My uncles, as they became the father figures in my family, and in particular, 3 of them were radicals, always involved in labor organizing or socialist, communist politics. It was sort of the 2 sides of the family. My uncle was a capitalist, and they were always opposed to that. So there was a lot of that kind of turmoil going on. My interest in science was cultivated by them, also classical music, everything. They were very much, in fact, atheism was probably part of it. I was discouraged from going to any kind of religious school, and I did not, what most Jewish kids that age would have gone to Bar Mitzvah. I was not. And next male influence in my life was when my mother got married a second time. She married an Italian man, Ernest Garofano, and eventually my half-brother was born. I just spoke to him a few minutes ago. About 12 years younger than I am. And so my stepfather came, and we moved across the street to a bigger apartment. He was a very interesting influence in my life, but he was not an intellectual influence. He was somebody who just was a very good person. He was very kind. And assumed the role of a father in a way that my own had not. And so I attended, eventually I finished grammar school at the age of about 13. I finished about a year ahead of the usual time. I went to Stuyvesant High School for the first year, and I guess I had pretty high grades on these Regents exams. Always had good grades in math. And I used to take the subway all the way down to 14th Street. It's quite a long ride, back and forth every day, and it was also, during certain times of the year, put me in proximity of being able to work for my uncle. And also, I had this rather ignominious task of going to visit my father's brother every week in order to pick up our support check.
From your father?
From my father. He did not condescend to put the check in the mail. That was too much trouble, and I developed a relatively close relationship with his brother, a man who I continued to see occasionally. And he ran a liquor store in Greenwich Village. And from the age of about 9 years on, I had to make that weekly trek down there. And so when I went to high school down in Union Square, I could walk across to Greenwich Village on my way home once a week, pick it up. And then during the summers, I worked for my uncle in the garment center, and which is a very hectic time of the year for that business. You're getting ready for the winter season. So I took clarinet lessons at Stuyvesant High School, and I remember buying my first clarinet down in the village somewhere. And I started working for my uncle Sam, and I remember
this,
my mother's oldest brother. In the summer, saying I was making eventually 30 cents an hour. That was the minimum wage. And I said to him, once, I'd like to get a raise. And he said, well, why? I said, well, I want to buy a clarinet. And he said, I'm not going to give you a raise, but as your uncle, I'll get you a clarinet. And so I think it cost me about $15 or something like that. And, Peddler was the brand. And I think they were made in Elkhart, Indiana. Eventually, though, for combination reasons, I guess either I didn't particularly like continuing to travel, or I wanted to study a second language. And the program at Stuyvesant, you had to take more science and less the other things. And I wasn't too excited by biology. I transferred schools, went up to DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx, which is the other end of the city. And eventually I graduated from Clinton, not without some problems. I was not a superstar student by any stretch of the imagination. And although I did well in math, always. In fact, one experience I had, one of my uncles and his wife decided to take a trip to Florida. And I don't know how everybody agreed to it, but I was allowed to go along on this trip. And as a consequence of that, I failed one or two courses in high school. I think one of them was history, and the other was, I don't know what. And I had to make these courses up in the summertime, which I subsequently did. But at the same time, I got in a kind of a mood where I just wanted to take all the easy courses. And I saw that there were things that you could take for credit, like typing and printing and multigraphing, all these things which have proven very important in my business. I became a super typist, which I used many times in my life after that. And eventually I did graduate, and I was... Funny, we were talking about this just last week when I was in Denver, and I always had this hankering to go west. I used to read Zane Grey stories and a lot. And I had always romanticized the notion of that west. I applied to the University of Arizona and Colorado, and I was accepted in Boulder. In the summer of 42, I went out there, and I wasn't going to be a chemical engineering major. I registered as a chemical engineering major.
What had given you that?
Pardon me?
What had given you that idea?
That's a very strange, difficult thing for me to explain. I don't know why I chose chemical engineering as a major. I sort of toyed with going to the Colorado School of Mines. I don't remember if I applied to get in or what. It was something, I always, the mining thing, I was much influenced by the literature my uncles gave me about the Wobblies and the old labor movement. And so I might have wanted to be a mining engineer, and maybe that had something to do with it. I just don't really, I had at some point, I think my uncle had a chemistry set. I never had one myself. That uncle, oddly enough, who had a great aptitude for science, wound up getting a business degree, and it was a great disappointment to me. None of my uncles, except that one, graduated from college, and he was sort of my buddy and wound up, as I said, taking a business degree. So I just don't know. I got out there, and then in college, I had to deal with things like mechanical engineering mechanical drawing, and I never found that kind of thing very interesting, and I didn't have much of an aptitude for it. I also met my first wife there, and
in Colorado,
in Boulder. She was older than I am. She was 7 years older, and was a physics major. And we were in the same, that's where I met her, in chemistry class, as a matter of fact. And although I didn't know that she would be introduced to me later by somebody else, I did, but I, she was in the same lecture hall, and I used to see her come in every day. But that summer, the story I told in Denver, in fact, I had it written out in about 100 words, a friend of mine, my uncle had a friend who was a labor organizer. His name was Carl Campbell, who eventually became a professor of economics in the Midwest somewhere. He was a very interesting man. He was an albino, but he was a union organizer. And when I went out there, my uncle said, "Go see Carl. He'll take care of you during the summer," because I'd gone out there early in the school. And I wound up, as a consequence of that, he got me a job down at Pando, Colorado, which is not far from Leadville. And that was when I got my first job as a laborer, and working in this construction camp, which was building an army ski troop camp, okay? And which eventually became Camp Hale. And I stayed there for only a couple of weeks, and then I got sick, and then I eventually went back to Denver. It was quite a harrowing experience for me, never having done that kind of physical labor. It was 12 hours a day, and temperature extremes were awful. But I survived. Then I finally went back to Boulder, and I went to school. But I only lasted, I think I stayed in school for 6 months. And there's a lot of details left out of this, but part of it was eventually my biological father had agreed to pay for part of my college. And when I said I was quitting, they were upset about that, but I was having personal, I just loved, and I wasn't, and I wanted to get away. The war was on, and I and got this kind of patriotic fever and wasn't quite ready for the Army. I was 17, I guess, when I got to college, and then I wasn't quite 18. So I went out to California to work in the shipyard. And my wife's sister was out there. We were friends. And I worked in the shipyards. Eventually I got trained as a welder. And then I went back for a while to Colorado because I knew that I was on my way to getting of draft age. And I stopped and I worked in Denver. They had what they call an inland shipyard.
That's in line.
They just made the sections of the ships there in this place. And I worked as a welder. And a friend of mine, Bert, who I'd made a friend of at school, was the son of a congressman, Richard Aspinwall. We worked together there, I remember. And then finally, I left and went back to New York at the age of, and I volunteered to join the Merchant Marine. But before I had gone down to the Merchant Marine School, the draft board got me. Like a darn fool. I was a young kid. I thought, you know, this card came in, I had to respond instantly. And I went and they drafted me before I got into the Merchant Marine. Then I wound up in the infantry. Then I went to basic training. And during basic training is when I found out when my typing would become the first interesting example of how it could help me. Because I was, before very long, I was offered the job as a company clerk, which I didn't take. But what happened was, after basic training, you could volunteer for the paratroops or for the ski troops, mountain troops. So I volunteered for the mountain troops so I could get back to Colorado and see my girlfriend. And that happened. They accepted me. And I went back to Camp Hale. And was in that outfit for about 8 months. And then eventually what happened was they left there and they went to Texas. And in Texas I signed up for officer training school. And I went to officer training school and for about 13 weeks and then there was something going on with the, I forget what it was, the bulge, and they started pulling people over into the overseas, what do you call it, the port of embarkation. But I never did finish the officer training school, and when I got to Fort George Meade, I was sent to the hospital. I was diagnosed as having ulcers. And I'll never forget when the Army, the major or somebody, the medical doctor comes down, and my mother comes down to visit me, and she said, the doctor says to my mother, Mrs. G, I have the sad news to tell you, I'm going to have to let your son out of the Army. And my mother started crying. And he thought that she was, you know, really super patriot, you know, something like that. But it was already, by the way, it was already June 1945, or April, and so the war was practically over anyhow. But so when I got out of the Army, I went back to summer school right away. I started planning for college, and I went to Columbia University that summer, and I studied French. And then I applied to school. By this time, during the time I was in the Army, my wife-to-be was already at Berkeley. And she was working at the, in fact, Lawrence Radiation Lab. And had switched from physics to medical physics. And eventually she became a pre-med student. And when I got out...
She graduated sometime.
She graduated in physics at Boulder. And when I got out to California, we eventually got married, and we were both pre-medical together, but she was a whiz student, straight A's. However, so we're in Berkeley for 2 years. That's when I took my first chemistry course with Joel Hildebrand, as a matter of fact. I described this somewhere, but I remember Professor Hildebrand very well. In fact, we had some correspondence long after I graduated. He wrote to me once about the citation index and wanted to know if I could help him use it to uncover what he thought was the over-mathematization of chemistry. I don't think it was very helpful to him on that, but nevertheless. So I took all the usual undergraduate pre-med courses. I was not a particularly good student. And after 2 years, my wife, my son was born in 1947, January. My oldest son, Stephen, he was born, in fact, in Stanford University Hospital, which was then located in San Francisco. And we came east because my wife was accepted at Temple University Medical School. And then when I got to New York, I moved into an apartment that my mother had had. And my wife announced that she was splitting with somebody else who had been a friend of ours. And they are still married, God bless them. They were obviously meant for each other. And he was a physicist also that she'd met out there. And I'll never know to this day, it was good at people's misguided loyalties, why she married me when all along she was in love with him. But people do those things, you know.
So this was summer of 47, where you were?
Well, she had met him in 45, in Berkeley, I guess, at the lab. He's still alive. He's a very nice guy. He was a protege of Oppenheimer, I think, and eventually got his PhD under him at Princeton. I don't know the details. I'm not sure. So we had some it was a very, very difficult time, and as a consequence of that, I obtained the custody of our child.
And that was very unusual for that era, wasn't it?
Yeah, but actually she probably preferred it that way, although she wouldn't have refused, I don't think, but she really, well, she'd have dragged him up in Philadelphia. They were living down here. She was going to medical school. How she would have managed, I'm not sure. What she did was, in fact, we had a stepson. I have a stepson. She'd been married before. In fact, twice before. Very unusual woman. And she sent one of the children off to live with her mother. In fact, made a deal with him. So for that purpose, and Grandma was happily willing to help support her through school as long as she had the child there to live with her. And she'd have done the same with my son. But that's how I got interested in child care. And I could not get my son into a child care facility because the rules and regulations were that if you had any female in your family able or willing to take care of your child, the city wasn't going to allow you to bring him to a child care. So I tried to, first I tried a private one, and then eventually I had a temporary nanny I hired. I had gone through different periods where I hired a nanny for the baby and was driving a cab, getting a GI Bill at the same time. And so I continued my studies. I continued that way. And then I moved in with another girl, another person who had another child, and we shared the expenses of a maid in the house. Eventually, that did not work out all too well, but I continued for until I gradually, I think in my senior year, my son went to live with my sister, who lived in the Bronx. I did that even though I would have preferred he live with my mother. She wasn't feeling well enough to do it. And my sister had a very strange husband who eventually played a role in my son coming back to live with me several years later. But nevertheless, when I graduated from college, February 49, and by then, by the way, I was a chemistry major. I had switched from pre-med to chemistry for the simple reason I had become my objective was to get a degree in biochemistry. I was studying under what they call was GI Bill for disabled veterans, and you had to have a very specific vocational objective, and pre-med was not achievable in the time that was allotted to me, medical school. So biochemistry with a master's was the objective. And in fact, in 49, I was accepted at Penn in physiological chemistry. And I had suffered a basically what amounted was a slipped disc, a herniated disc, and I was admitted to the hospital here. And as a consequence of that episode, I had to drop out of school. And then I went back to New York, and then eventually got a job, different jobs. Very difficult to get a job as a chemist in those days. I was working as a sales correspondent for a while for something called LaSalle University, which was really a mail order correspondence school.
Selling the courses?
I was the person, my typing again, you see, I was really a glorious file clerk. But what I did was I had to take the coupons that people wrote, sent in when they clipped them out of the Popular Science magazine or something like that, and get all the information on them, look them up in the phone book and what have you, and put together the information for the salesman. And then these sales telemarketing people would get on the phone and convince these people that they needed to either buy the course or they'd arrange an appointment to go see them. And as part of that deal, I got a free course in, I got to take a free course in stenography, which I was interested in. I learned shorthand, and I learned stenotype as well. Well, finally, I did get a job. I applied in several chemical companies. I couldn't get a job, and I don't know whether it was discrimination or what. Back in those days, fairly strong racial religious quotas. Even 5 years later, I can remember of Smith, Kline, and French. It was rather unusual for the Jews to get hired. And people may forget that nowadays, but it was very much the case back when I was still in college. But I didn't pay any attention to that. I eventually got a job working in a small company called Evans Cosmetics R&D. It was a consulting firm, and they did research projects, and then I got hired as a junior chemist.
So you really had identified yourself as a chemist in some way at this juncture.
Well, I had this degree in chemistry, and I first I got this other job. I went to Evans Chemical. So finally, then I after the sales job, sales correspondence, I got this job, which was not that far away. And I went in there, and they one of the things that came out when I was working for them, at one point, they brought me into one of these conferences with a client, and I was asked to take notes. And they didn't know, of course, that I had this little flair for taking notes and what have you. And then I came back with a report. They were overwhelmed the fact that I could digest everything that was said there. So that aptitude must have been there. But before I'd been with them for 3 or 4 months, I then was offered a job as the laboratory assistant to Professor Louis P. Hammett at Columbia, where I graduated from. But that was purely a coincidence, was that my own cousin was his PhD student.
This is long ago.
Sidney Bernhardt.
French.
Was Louis P. Hammett's...
Your mother's French.
My mother's, yeah, a first cousin of mine. And Sidney was a brilliant scientist. He's a professor of molecular biology at the University of Oregon, I think. And you know, knew that I was interested in getting back into school somehow, and they needed this lab assistant, so I got hired. And so I signed up as a graduate student again. However, I soon found out that I certainly was not well suited for physical chemistry. But it was there in that lab that I first got exposed to, first of all, Louis P. Hammett was the editor of the McGraw-Hill book series. He had a fabulous library. And secondly, I used to do some of the literature searching. They had a full set of chemical abstracts there. And then on top of that, they had this closet full of chemicals that had been synthesized by generations of students at Columbia. Thousands of compounds. And one day, after I'd been struggling to make a series of compounds for these, we were doing acid-base catalysis one of their sponsors was Roman Haas, as a matter of fact. They were producing these ion exchange resins, and they were using the ion exchange resins as a catalytic bed. And I had to make this series of compounds, and I saw this closet and found out that there were dozens of these things already there, and all I had to do was purify them. I wouldn't have to make them. And so I got very well incented to create an index to this file of compounds. And that's eventually, after several explosions in the lab and other incidents, Dr. Hammett realized that I was not really going to make it to as a physical chemist, at least according to his standards. And I decided that I would look for other work.
So you had actually got a publication in the Journal of the American Chemical Society.
Yeah, that's right, working with him, yeah. Right, yeah. Well, I think they were very generous to include me as an author. And, but, you know, I did the lab work, and I understood what was going on at the time, but I don't think that I contributed any other significant ideas to this project. Certainly, Sidney Bernhardt was the graduate student, and of course, Professor Hammond. But there you are, there's my first paper. And I told Professor Hammett that I was going to look for other work, and what had happened was that I applied I decided to combine. Somebody told me, why don't you combine your chemistry with your all this knowledge you had of stenography and everything. I applied for a job, and I think I was accepted by to be secretary to the director of research at, I think, the Ethel Corporation in Detroit, which for them, I guess, would have been great if I could find a secretary with science training. But end of 1950, or the beginning of 1951, I went to an American Chemical Society, the Diamond Jubilee meeting. I'd never been to an ACS meeting before. And I guess that was part of this job thing. Maybe that was where I got the interview for this job. While I was there, I stumbled into the Division of Chemical Literature. And it sort of became apparent to me that there were people who actually made a living doing this kind of work. And Jim Perry was chairing the session, I believe, and James Perry was, he was one of the pioneers in my field, and had just published a book How to Teach Yourself Scientific Russian, and he was about to publish a book with Bob Casey of the Schaefer Pen Company on punch cards, which punch cards are applications of science and industry. And I guess Jim was chairman or something of the Division of Chemical Literature in those days, and after he got through, the session broke, he came down off the platform, and I walked up to him, and I said to him, can you tell me, how do you get a job in this racket? Because to me, it was like, I couldn't believe people got paid for that. I would have done it for nothing. So he smiled, and he was a giant of a man. I still have contact with his wife. He's long since dead. Ruth Perry is a very nice lady, and she lives in Tucson, Arizona. Jim was, I think, a chemical engineer by training, and he said, okay, I'll be in touch with you, and to make a long story short, he arranged to meet me, and he was then working at MIT. He had this project at MIT, and I think Alan Berry and Alan Kent were working with him. Alan Kent eventually went on to become the dean of the School of Library and Information Science in Pittsburgh. Madeline Berry is still she's still involved part-time, I think, in the field. She worked at the National Science Foundation. She was one of the grant administrators at one point. He said to me, I think that we could find a job for somebody on this project. And so then Jim Perry arranged to come back several weeks. He met me at my mother's house in the Bronx, and I'll never forget it because she fixed him this fantastic meal, and he loved Jewish cooking. And he then presented me with a copy of his new book on punch cards. And he said, okay, we're going to hire you. He called me up a week or so later, and he said, can you hang on for a few more weeks? By then I had to turn down. I had to turn down this job in Detroit. He calls me up and he says, well, things have changed. Would you be interested in a job in Baltimore? We can't pull it off in Boston, but there's a job in Baltimore. And next thing I knew, I was down at Johns Hopkins University being interviewed by Sanford Larkey, who was the director of the Welch Medical Library, and who was also director of the machine indexing project sponsored by the then Armed Forces Army Medical Library. And I didn't know until I got hired that I really wasn't working for Jim Perry. Jim was a friend of St. Larky's, and maybe out of kindness or whatever, instead of just turning me down, he didn't have the job, he figured that I was a good person. They needed a replacement on this project for Wilhelmina Himwich, who was a brain physiologist, she and I eventually became very good friends. I still see her occasionally. She's retired. She was the scientist on this project that had been started 2 or 3 years before I got there.
The thought behind the project being?
It was a project which has been described at great length in the literature, which the predecessor to the National Library of Medicine, which was then Army Medical Library, Armed Forces Medical Library, and then eventually National Library of Medicine, were studying new ways of dealing with the medical literature. The methods that we were using were hopelessly out of date. The index catalog was years behind. They had just started recently the current list of medical literature, and it was having problems. So all sorts of machine methods of searching literature were being considered. And when I came to the project, they had done very little with actual machine methods. They had done something with coding. They'd studied the abstracting and indexing coverage of medical journals. When I got there, we got hot and heavy into the problem of subject heading analysis. And we together developed what is today the MESH, Medical Subject Heading Authority List. Well, that predecessor work goes back to that project. And Dr. Larky hired me. It turns out, rather strangely, because I found this only after I left the project, or was leaving, that he hired me because Professor Hammett had told him that I was a very hard-working, dedicated individual, but not a particularly original thinker. And this was exactly what Dr. Larky wanted. Of course, they didn't get what he bargained for. So, my mother had given me some money for graduation. I'd given all that to my sister to take care of my son. The woman who was supposed to be subsequently to become my second wife, we split up. Because she didn't want to go to Baltimore unless I got married, and I wasn't ready to get married again. So I went there and I became a bachelor again, and I lived in Baltimore and worked at the project. So they needed a chemist on this project, by the way, because the first assignment I got was working with the enzyme and chemical nomenclature. So during this 2 years on this project, I always say that practically everything that I've ever done in some way or another is attributable to the thought processes that went on in the basic research. And I met all kinds of interesting people who were stimulus to a lot of the things that I've done. Chauncey Leake was chairman of what they call the Honorary Committee of Consultants. The committee were all the outstanding figures in the field at the time. I mean, it was, for a young guy that didn't know anything about it, it was really an incredible thing. And Verna Clapp, the chief assistant librarian of Congress, Mortimer Talby, also library of Congress, and started his own business, and Brad Rogers I met, through that project, he had been appointed the new director of the Army Medical Library, Seymour Tain, you know, all sorts of people that I met, Stel Brodman, who became quite a respected historian of medicine herself, even though she was basically a medical librarian. She combined them in a way that nobody I know ever has. And San Rocky was a dilettante. While he was alive, I didn't really, wasn't able to say too much about him. He was a man who, he had problems with alcohol, too. He came in 9 o'clock every day. He would engage me in conversation about his wartime experiences and his interest in Elizabethan medicine during the day. And we worked in the afternoon. We worked on subject heading analysis. He loved that. And we talk about the origins of words and what have you. And we worked on the WHO classification. We assigned all these category numbers to the subject headings. I mean, there's a whole literature on this. And at 5 o'clock, he would go home. And at 5 o'clock, I would be doing research. And eventually, they got the 101 statistical machine came in there, and I started playing around with it. And I invented various systems for searching literature with punch card machines. And there's a whole series of things that went on.
So unlike the Columbia lab and the chemical company, you've really found your métier.
Yeah, I mean, then I really felt, I mean, I didn't mind working 24 hours a day. At first I lived in the red light district down in Baltimore because when I first came there, Dr. Larkey had introduced me to somebody, got me an apartment. I moved into a very nice room on near Charles Street, in a very nice section of Baltimore. And I wanted to play the saxophone. The people objected to that, so eventually I had to move out of there. I could tell some funny stories about Dr. Larkey and how I was evicted because there was a Republican judge, and Larkey came down to defend me. And when he saw Larkey, whose wife was a Democratic National Committee woman, he immediately said, "Get out!" And I decided to move to some place nobody would bother me. I got this room on the corner of Mount Royal and Charles Street, overlooking the drugstore. And it was a huge room, the size of this office, basically, higher ceilings. And the landlord was the retired pharmacist who was a collected parakeets. And he had another room the size of this with 100 cages full of these parakeets, all of which were illegal at the time because they had these laws against them spreading psittacosis and everything. But he let me play the saxophone anytime I wanted. And eventually what happened was one time I had gone away for the weekend and Dr. Larkey tried to get a hold of me, and he had come down to look for me. And when he saw where I was living, he was terribly upset. I mean, I don't know why. He said, "This is no place for a respectable young man," because it really was the red light district. In fact, the lady downstairs from me was a stripper. And he said, "Why don't you get yourself a room right near Johns Hopkins?" He found me a room right over the drugstore opposite Johns Hopkins Hospital emergency entrance. I'm going to tell you, that was an experience. And I had a room, an apartment that was like the size of a closet. But I was within stone's throw, literally, of the Welsh Library. And that's where I finished up. And I worked there literally day and night. And eventually, I think one of the culminating experiences was that in March of 53, we had agreed to sponsor a symposium on our work, public symposium. And Sam Larkey was supposed to give a talk, and I was supposed to give a talk, and one of the other fellows in the project was supposed to give a talk. As it turned out, both of them copped out. Larky claimed illness, and the other guy did too. So I had to give all the papers. And it was a one-day symposium. We had 300 people came. It was called the First Symposium on Machine Methods and Scientific Documentation. There's a brief write-up in a journal called Special Libraries by Marjorie Hislop. And it was a result of that symposium. We had one of the newspapers sent a reporter around, and the vice president of the university had been our opening speaker, Hall J. Reed. And he was the one that used this expression, man is going to be drowned in a flood of paper. And this thing hit the United Press or something like that, and it got national coverage. And we started getting letters from all over the country asking for information on this symposium. And one of the letters that I got was from a retired vice president of Shepherd Citation, W.C. Adair. And he told me that when Shepherd Citations had originally been in New York, he had been approached by some groups in the Engineering Society or something like that about the idea of organizing literature using their methods. But I didn't know what Shepherd's was, so I went down to the Enoch Pratt Free Library went into the reference room somewhere, and I found Shepherd Citations, and I literally screamed eureka, because I had been trying to devise a system around review articles, which Chauncey Leak had been pushing me to. He kept saying, review articles are extremely important to scientists. Study them carefully. Find out why they're so successful. And I had done this analysis, kind of a linguistic analysis of a review, in which essentially what you do is, if you parse a review article, you take each sentence becomes an indexing statement. Now, Henry Small recently has just reversed it. With citation indexing, we are now going into a citing article and pulling out a citing sentence. I was taking the review article and analyzing each sentence and tagging it with the article that it cited. So when I saw the Shepherd Citations, I found the methodology that I needed for linking all these things, for indexing all these cited references that were cited in reviews. And so I began a correspondence with Mr. Adair. However, I was out of the project within 3 months of that time. I was literally fired. Dr. Larky terminated my employment because he was angry as could be with me for a lot of reasons, including he claimed that I refused to stop publishing something called Contents in Advance. Contents in Advance I had started the year before. And what it was the contents pages of all the library and documentation journals.
The year before, in 52.
Yeah, in 52. Just a second. And I couldn't see why we couldn't do that. Now, that was one of the disagreements. The fact is that the project was being terminated anyhow by the national, the Army Medical Library. They weren't going to renew the contract. And the net effect of that was that I was burned out of my vacation. And we parted. He was hostile to me until the very end. Never had a pleasant word to say to me until he died. And in fact, after I left Hopkins, Larky was very weird about publishing. I could never get him to agree that something was ready for publication. So when I left, I submitted several manuscripts that I had written for publication. In one case, a paper that I eventually got published in the Journal of Documentation, he actually got the university attorney after me to try and prevent my publishing this paper, an innocuous paper on the preparation of subject heading lists by punch card methods, which certainly did not turn out to be a classic, but there it is. It was one of my first papers ever published. And I had to, so all of my contact with Mr. Adair came after I left the Welch Project. I went up to Columbia University. A couple of my friends had advised me that if I wanted to stay in the field, it would be a good idea if I got a library degree, because I had been mixing with all these librarians, but I didn't have a professional qualification. So I went to Columbia Library School during the summer, and I don't remember how I scrounged up the money to pay for the summer session, but I did. I went there for the summer session. And I found out that, you know, I could get a master's degree in 1 year. And luckily, Dean Carl White had seen, observed me, and told me about the Grolier Society Fellowship, which was sponsored by the Encyclopedia Americana. I applied for this fellowship, and I got it. And the reason that I got it, when they asked for my references, I gave them as references the director of the National Agricultural Library, the director of the Army Medical Library, and the chief assistant librarian of Congress, Berta Clapp.
All knew me from the previous project.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And Ralph Shaw was one of the people. And Brad Rogers.
Getting that fellowship was obviously...
Oh, it made the difference because I couldn't afford it.
But weren't you, before that, weren't you getting a little discouraged?
Well, at that point, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had been told by people, the National Science Foundation, several years, why didn't I apply for a grant? Well, they weren't giving grants to unaffiliated individuals. And it's a lot of nonsense. I still resent that. Why should you have to be affiliated with a university in order to be able to qualify to get a grant? But it's all part of this bureaucratic notion that people steal. I mean, if you're an individual and you got a $5,000 grant, let's say, God knows what you do with the money. Spend it to eat. So, I did get that fellowship, and I graduated. I think I was the top student of the class. But before I had graduated, during that year is when I published my major paper on citation indexing.
This was the science.
In science, yeah. I submitted it during the year that I also submitted a paper. I became friendly with Adair. I was an editor, I was the youngest editor of American Documentation. Jesse Shearer knew me and asked me to become an editor. I must say that was quite a...
That's a dare,
pretty easy
when he refers to...
Yeah, and I was the one who suggested to Adair to write this article as editor of American Documentation. And after he wrote this paper, then I said I would do my other paper.
That itself was American Documentation was a new journal.
Well, relatively, it was the journal of the American Documentation Institute. But the American Documentation Institute had just become, quite recently, in fact, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of ACES now, but it wasn't always an individual membership group. The year I joined was the first year you could join as an individual. So that's how he did this. And a year later, the summer of 1955, I drove out there with my son to visit Mr. Adair in Colorado Springs. And so I got this thing published, and I got my paper in Science published in 55, but I did all the work while I was at Columbia. And 53 to 54 is when I did that. Now, while I was at Columbia, I had decided to continue my doctoral work in the field of mechanical translation. Because all during that time I had followed that field, and a very close friend of mine, Casimir Borkowski, was working with Leon Doster, who was the leading exponent at the time of mechanical translation at Georgetown University.
Mechanical translation?
Of mechanical translation of Russian and foreign languages. And I was going to come to work down there. Cass Borkowski was already working with us there. By the time, however, I finished my work at Columbia, several things had happened. First of all, I had tried to put together a PhD program. And at Columbia, it was in order to, I didn't want to do it on any subject that was, you know, there were no professors that really understood this field. So you had to put together what they call an interdisciplinary committee. And I got three or four professors to agree to serve on this committee, but I could never get them to meet. I had, one of them was a chemical physicist, Professor Kimball, who was a computer guy. And my topic was going to be machine methods of scientific documentation, you know, the application of computers. And I couldn't swing it. I couldn't get them to do it. In the meantime, I got a call from Ted Hertigan at Smith, Kline & French. And he had met me down at the Welch Project. And just about that time was when Thorazine had really burst on the scene. And Smith Kline was just inundated with information that they had to have processed. Ted said to me, come on, why don't you come down? He was a really sweet man, and Ted convinced me to come down and work for them temporarily for 6 months. And he said, you could earn a little money, and after your 6 months, then you could go back to Georgetown University, continue your work, and so forth. So I came down here in the summer of 54. Okay. And I guess the reason for the discrepancies in these dates is the time lags in the submissions. You know, it took a hell of a long time to get papers published in those days. Because my paper in Science, interestingly enough, the person who helped me most in editing that paper, even though it didn't get published until 55, I think, was H. Bentley Glass, who was a professor of genetics at Johns Hopkins. But he was one of the editors of Science, I think, or something like that, or referee or whatever. And he went over the manuscript and really helped improve it. And eventually it got it published, because it was a hit and miss as to whether it would get published. So Ted convinced me to come down, and I was desperate, you know, for money by that time, and I had to make a decision. So I came down and worked for Smith Kline. That's how I got down here. But while I was at Columbia, there was a number of things that I worked on. I worked on the idea of an encyclopedia. I did a term paper on that. And that's the origin for the Atlas Encyclopedia. I really wanted to do a different kind of encyclopedia as well. During that time, I also did the paper on using citation indexes for patents. And I published a paper in the Journal of Patent Office Society, which came about the same time. And I had several of the students help me. One was a student, Marge Terrain, from Merck. She's still, I think, still with Merck, but in one of the different parts of the company. I continued to publish contents in advance, even in library schools. also with the help of Ann McCann and some other library school students.
What was the circulation of that, and who was it going to?
It was going to library schools and librarians. You know, it was very small. Even within a year or so, I had to fold it. I mean, it was $6 a year what it cost. I couldn't keep it up anymore. I turned it over to the people, Ann McKeon and the others, and let them have it. And I think they tried to publish it for a little while, and they couldn't.
That was in 50?
Yeah, 55. We used to do this size page, and we reduced them down, 4 contents pages to a page. Most of the library journals were relatively small.
Do any of those
samples exist?
Yeah.
I don't know. They might. I don't know if we have one here or not. I haven't seen one. I'm sure you could find one in some library catalog somewhere.
How long did the Smith Kline consultant?
Oh, well, so I came to work at Smith Kline, and what happened was that I came down as a consultant, and I was living, working here 4 days a week. And I stayed at the Broadwood Hotel, the place that is now the health club at Broad and Vine. That was the old location of the Broadwood Hotel. So I could walk from Smith Kline down there. I had his room there. And several years later, I was to find out that I was misinformed that I could deduct my travel expenses as a tax deduction, even though I was living in New York, because the Internal Revenue said that my principal residence was Philadelphia. That if you work 4 days a week for a certain period of time, that's where you live, and you kept your apartment in New York for convenience. That's in the end of that. But what happened was that in the winter, November, December of that year, my sister called me and told me that my brother-in-law had gone berserk, and that I should come and get my son, take him down and live with me, which I did. And that's where Ted Hurrigan, again, as a friend, what happened was that I then rented a house across the road from Ted, who lived in Mullican Hill, New Jersey, back 4 miles south of Mullican Hill. I rented a house for $20 a month. It's a 3-room house on an asparagus farm. And my son came to live with me. He was, by then he was 7 years old. And he went to school down in Mauka Hill, Harrison, I forget the name of it, Harrisonville Township. And I drove to work every day with Ted Hertigan. And his sister took care of my son after school. And we lived down there for about a year or more until I got in the summer of 1955. I went out to Colorado to visit Mr. Adair. And on the way back, we stopped in Chicago. And I met my previous girlfriend, who I'd met in 1948, the year after I was divorced, when I was still at Columbia. And we decided to get married. So I then moved to Woodbury, New Jersey for a few months, and then we moved to Thoroughfare, New Jersey, where we had a log cabin, which we rented, a log cabin and a chicken coop. And I converted the chicken coop into my office. All this time I was still a consultant with Smith Kline. She took a job as a secretary at the Franklin Institute. And eventually we had three children. And what happened was that at Smith Kline, they wanted me to work full time, and I made the decision that I wasn't going to be happy working full time for them. But I kept on as a part time consultant with them for several years.
Was that as much as a couple of days a week?
A couple of days a week, yeah. And the rest of the time I had other clients, or basically I began to devote myself more and more. What happened was that I had clients, I did a study for Biological Abstracts. There's a major study for them called Biological Abstracts in an Era of Automation. That was with Miles Conrad, who's now long since dead. And I even did a consulting job for the Encyclopedia Americana. And gradually, what happened somewhere along the line, a friend of mine, Charlotte Studer, subsequently married a man named Mitchell, was the librarian at Miles Laboratories. And they, before that, I had launched. What happened was that I had decided to do a current contents in social and management science. And just as I had announced that, Bell Laboratories heard about it and had been planning to do something similar. So I made a contract with them to produce my publication, which was called Management's Documentation Preview. And I would put a separate cover on 500 copies for them, which they call a Survey of Current Management Literature. And that contract lasted actually for about 8 years. But the year of that contract was a very, very momentous one, because that's how I was introduced to the Household Finance Corporation.
This is 55.
55, I think it is, yeah. Well, let's see. Well, this didn't happen. I got this thing in 1958. I've written this up as an article about how I got my money from that. This is what happened was that I got this contract, but I had to go to a, instead of printing these things that they had been doing for the Xerox machine, they had to use a regular printer. I couldn't do such a large quantity that way. And the printer wouldn't give me the material unless I paid them. And they needed, the contract was for twice monthly, I believe. And it was like $15,000 over a year's time. But they wouldn't pay me anything up front. I had to finance the first issue. So I thought this purchase order would be sufficient. I went to the banks. I went to the first in Woodbury, and then I went to banks all over Philadelphia. And they would not advance me any money on that purchase order. They said it was not an account receivable, which is true. And as one put it, you could walk out in the street tomorrow and get hit by a car, and where would we be? Which I didn't know how to answer it in those days. I don't know why they never heard of insurance, but I was really up against it, and I didn't know what to do. I had gone back a second time to the Woodbury Trust Company, and Mr. Fowler was a very nice man. He said to me, listen, he said, there's no way this bank is going to lend you money. In those days, the interest was 6%, you know, per annum. And he said, but I'll tell you, if you go down the street to Household Finance, they will lend you $500 on your signature. I couldn't believe it. And also, if you grew up in the Depression, finance companies were, I mean, it was like you were in the hands of the devil. Okay? And anyhow, I went down there, and sure enough, the guy sat me down. He asked me the usual questions, the sign, $500. And I found out some very interesting things about financing, which I had described in an article. But the essence of it was this, that a bank will lend you money at 6% per annum in those days, which is the equivalent of 0.5% per month. But they will make a charge on it, and furthermore, a service charge. And they will also say that you will only be able to you must keep the money for at least a month. You pay for each month. Well, if you're borrowing $500, that means you're paying $10 for the first month, plus the service charge. Let's say it was, I don't know, $10. That's $20 to borrow $500 for 1 month. Okay. Household Finance charges you 18% per annum. But there is no service charge. 1.5% a month on $500 is $7.50. Okay? Furthermore, if you wanted to, you could return the money in 2 days or 3 days or whatever. I borrowed the $500. I got the stuff printed. And I had to wait about turned out an agonizingly long time, over a month, I think it was. Bell Labs didn't deliberately do it, but somehow there was a screw-up, and I did not get a check for quite some time. But I went back there to the Household Finance, and I said, here's your money. And he says to me, what are you kidding? He says, you're going to pay me off so soon? I said, what are you talking about? He said, I thought you would be tickled at that, but I paid my debts. So that's not the way we make money. So I said to him, all right, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll pay you this one off. Next time I'll be back here. And I came back to him because, you know, the expenses started coming in again, and I needed, not only did I need $500, I needed more than $500 because I now was faced with the promotional costs. Right? Because I needed money to promote it. So I said to him, listen, I'm going to borrow this $500 from you, but I said, I'll make a deal with you. How do I get $1,000? He said, $500 is the limit. There's a state limit. I said, Jesus, that's too bad. He said, but you know, and they didn't have computers in those days. He said, that's just this branch. They don't know from one branch to the next what they're doing. So he says, if I give you the name of a guy down in Camden, he says, you can borrow another $500. Well, I started going around. That's how I got this card. And that's how I financed my business. Of course, it got to the point where I didn't need it. But as long as I was not overly ambitious with the borrowing, I was able to manage. There was one period, by the way, where here's how Current Contents got its name. This management publication with the contract from Bell Labs, I met a public relations man named Harry Brager. Don't ask me how I met him. I think I met him through a printer in Washington. And Harry Brager and this printer came to me and they said, we'll give you $5,000, we'll be partners on this publication with you, and we'll start promoting it as a subscription publication. And he said, this name, Management Documentation Printer, has got to be the worst title ever anyone could ever imagine. And I had to agree. He said, why don't you give it some kind of a simple name, and we start talking, Current Contents, that's what it is, okay? That's Current Contents. Well, I made this deal with them. They even gave me an office down at Free Thomas Circle in Washington. They then said something which I couldn't believe they were going to do, which was they wanted to take the entire $5,000 and spend it on one mailing. But they were going to bankroll this thing. If this thing really flew, then they put in more, $5,000, $10,000, where they keep on recycling it. The idea being, if you got a 1% response on the subscriptions at $25 a year, which is what it was, 50 subscriptions would be $1,000. And you take that cash and you put it into more mailings or whatever. They picked, I couldn't believe, they insisted on using a mailing list consisting of the highest paid individuals in the United States. In other words, anybody with an income over a certain amount of money, they assume could afford it and would want it. I told these guys, you guys have got to be crazy. They insisted on doing this. Well, it bombed. We got a total, I don't know, like we got about 20 subscriptions at most. I'll never forget the first one that came in was from the executive at Allen Wood Steel Company. And thing bombed, and they backed out and they said, it's yours. That's how I got the name. Well, I kept on trying, and at one point we actually discontinued that publication and eventually we resumed it under the name of Behavioral Social Science. In the meantime, that's when when Miles Labs came along, and she said to me, I'd like to do something for my people with medical journals. So I started doing a Xerox version of the contents page, about 100 journals for her in my chicken coop. And then eventually, when other drug companies bought in, I made a subscription policy that had to buy 25 subscriptions for $1,500, the way I had done it with her. But she bought 100, probably, it was now, some minimum. And that's how it got started. It wasn't until later on that it became a subscription thing where you could buy one copy, and that happened not out of any brilliant design on my part. What happened was that Dr. Jacob Gershon Cohen was a very famous radiologist in Philadelphia. He invented thermography. Excuse me a second. And he called me up and he said to me, Mr. Garfield, I've seen a copy of this thing that you're sending around to some of the drug companies. He said, it's a very fine thing. I could really make use of it in my work. But he said, I have a policy of never accepting gifts from drug companies. Why don't you sell me a subscription? Mail it to me every issue. And I said to him, gee, I don't know, I have no money. So I said to him, what do you think it's worth? About $2 a copy. $100 a year? He said, that sounds like manna from heaven to me. I said, absolutely, you got it. So that was how I decided to set price at $100 a year for one subscription.
When was that?
Oh, this is back 1958, 59, 60, I'm not sure. Not all that long after it started, a year or so.
And that's when it really began to be a commercial?
Well, I wasn't promoting it yet. I then got another phone call from Harold P. Rush, who was director of the McArdle Memorial Lab at University of Wisconsin, RUSCH. Dr. Rush says, I've been seeing this thing in the drug companies, and you know, this is something we can use in our labs. We have a lot of trouble keeping up the literature. Why don't you let us buy it? I told him, well, we only sell 25 copies. He said, that's okay, we can use 25. And I said, well, it's $1,500 a year. He said, that seems a little steep. Why don't you give us an academic discount? So I said, well, what does that sound like to you? And he said, 50%. So I said, $750, you got it. And that was how we had bulk subscriptions. We used to sell bulk subs. It was very heavily promoted in the beginning. And then later on, it was more individual. That's why it wasn't, I don't know the exact year we started offering it then. It was $50 a year for an individual academic.
At what moment did you hire somebody?
Well, that was when I hired my first, well, full time. See, in the early days, my wife did the pay stuff. And she was a secretary, so she knew how to handle. Although she worked at Franklin Institute, and then when the babies came, she worked out in the chicken coop and we put the thing together. Then I rented an office across the street from Smith Kline at 1523 Spring Garden Street. It's still there, I mean, it's still, the building is still there, and I'm sure it's lived in by somebody. I took the third floor of one of those tenements and made that my office. Eventually, well, I had a part-time, for a while, Claire Schultz worked part-time. She was a librarian from Merck who had gotten pregnant. She needed some part-time work. She worked part-time for me. And then I moved downstairs and occupied a little bigger space and hired my first and full-time employee. Was either Beverly Bartolomeo, who still works for me, and or a woman named Sylvia Shapiro, who was my secretary. They were my two. I then also hired, at that time, part-time, a guy who was just getting his master's degree in marketing, Penn State, a fellow named Marvin Schiller, who was first vice president of my company. Marv stayed with me for, I don't know, 10 years, and then left, together with a number of other people who worked. He was a part-time, and he did the first direct mail campaign on current contents, life sciences. That's how it grew.
Did he leave with some split-off group? Because you had a phenomenon like the computer industry, the Silicon Valley, with people moving out.
Did he move out to found his own company?
Yeah.
Well, what happened there was not a very, very pleasant kind of thing. I don't remember the exact year. After Current Contents was going, and we used to say, gee, won't it be some fantastic day when we have 5,000 subscribers? I had gotten a letter from Josh Lederberg in 1958, the year he got the Nobel Prize. And that letter has got to be a classic by itself, in which he says to me, for lack of a citation index, I cannot tell what happened to your article in Science. And that was how my correspondence began with people in the genetics community. And eventually, I met the head of the genetics study section of NIH. And they had a team of people visit me. And we then agreed to produce the genetics citation index, which, if you've never seen, I'll get a copy of it. Somebody seems to have borrowed mine, as a matter of fact. But nevertheless, that happened around the early 60s. Right? Now what happened was, we got that project completed. We produced 1,000 copies of the genetics index, which were distributed free to geneticists. In order to produce it, we had produced the 1961 SCI. The NSF had taken over the project from the NIH. We were given a $50,000 a year grant for 3 years. But NIH, under the Fountain Committee, Congressman Fountain had found some private company had absconded funds. And they then passed a rule that NIH would never again give grants to a private company. We had already halfway through the project. So what they did was, they transferred our contract, or grant, to the National Science Foundation and made it into a contract. And when the end of the contract came, I said to the NSF, I have all this data, why don't you let us publish the full SCI and distribute it? They said, nothing doing. So we had to make a decision whether to publish this or not. We made a decision to publish it and to launch the service as an ongoing service. We sold the first index for $500, and we launched a quarterly. We soon found out that this was not an idea that was going to sweep the world. And as a consequence, our finances got to be very precarious. One of our advisors mistakenly forecast that we would run out of cash at a certain time. And as a result, we were introduced to some financiers in New York, and a group bought a minority interest in the company. They acquired about 20% of the shares of the company as a result of that. They loaned us $500,000. It was a convertible debenture, which subsequently was all paid off. And that was why I say that the SCI almost bankrupted us, even though we were doing well in current countries. And then over the years, gradually it caught on. That $500,000 didn't do the trick. I mentioned the current content success, which did the trick. Well, I suppose it helped. Anyhow, that's how I got my first minority shareholder.
ISI itself was incorporated in 1960.
I had incorporated under the name of Eugene Garfield Associates. An interesting story there, because in 1956, in Jersey, I was called Documentation Inc. I changed it to Eugene Garfield Associates in Philadelphia. And the subtitle was Information Engineers. However, somehow, either the Society for Professional Engineers or some engineering group in the state wrote me a letter saying that it was against the law to call yourself an engineer unless you were an accredited graduate of an engineering school. And by the time 1960 rolled around, I had decided that we were going to emulate a multidisciplinary organization like Venuti. And I sort of said, well, we'll do with 24 people what they do with 2,000. And so I decided to call the Institute for Scientific Information. Part of it being motivated by the fact that we were operating in a nonprofit world. I mean, it just, the attitudes towards private companies in our field, it was just abominable. And that sort of took a stigma out of it for some people. To this day, some of them, I guess, think it's non-profit. Well, you know the old story about that. It's non-profit, but we didn't plan it that way. Which is the opposite of these big non-profits, which are for-profit, but they didn't plan it that way either.
Just to pursue the corporate organization dimension for one moment, that ISI was incorporated and wholly privately held in 1960, and then you had these outside finance people coming
in. Yeah,
and then you
in the
paid that back.
Middle 60s, I guess about 1964, they came in.
But the company has it gone public at some time?
We tried to go public one time, and the day that we went public, the market hit the rock bottom for that year or decade, I don't know what, it was like the market crashed here and hit real recession sort of type of thing. And there was a second attempt, and it never, the underwriters backed out. And then after a while, after the company became sufficiently self-supporting, the question was, why go public? What was the reason? I could think of some good reasons why we might have done it. So, there we are.
How did Index Chemicus plug in for this?
Oh, well, because of my close links to the pharmaceutical industry, I remained consultant to SmithKline for many years. Now, during that time, back in like 55, there's a local ACS chapter. Newman Bortnick remembers this very well. We saw him the other day at the meeting, and he reminded me of the committee. And we all were very unhappy with chemical abstracts, and we put together this local report, he and I and Max Gordon and some other people, criticizing chemical abstracts and giving him suggestions as to what they ought to do. In the meantime, in 1957, I had obtained a contract with the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association for about $15,000 to index the current steroid literature in cooperation with the United States Patent Office. We were to code these indexing sheets and turn them over to the Patent Office in order to facilitate punch card searching of those patents. Well, in the process of doing that, which we did very well, and we indexed tens of thousands of steroids, which was a huge growing field, I got to see that there were interesting possibilities as to what could be done to make current abstracts, chemical abstracts, current. And at the same time, this is all part of my thinking and my doctoral work, which At the same time all these other things were going on, in 1955, I started my PhD program at Penn under Zelig Harris, who I had been introduced to by my friend Cass Borkowski, who had come from Georgetown up here, and he was in the same group as Chomsky, working under Harris. And so Cass introduced me to Zelig Harris. I, in turn, introduced Zelig Harris to information retrieval, which got him, eventually, a $500,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. And he recognized the potential, and he agreed, after I told my story about how I couldn't get my PhD at Columbia, that I would work there on my PhD, and we agreed on the program and how much credits I'd have to take, and he let me transfer 30 credits, from which I had, by the way, I had not only done my library school credits, I had other credits I had taken. So I really was 60 credits. They gave me 30 credits, and I agreed to pay for 30 credits my PhD, you know, that whole the requirements. And my topic was mechanical translation of temporal nomenclature, actually, more specifically. I told Harris that, you know, this was something that people thought could not be done. He was not competent to judge the chemical significance of it. Professor Alan Day of the chemistry department knew me through Max Gordon, who had been one of his students. Max Gordon was at Smith Kline. And he agreed to be the co-shepherd of my PhD and give the linguistics people input to say, well, this is chemically okay. And eventually, that's how I got my PhD at Penn. But, so I had been very chemically oriented all during this time, and one of the problems that Smith Kline and all the drug companies had was the fact that chemical abstracts indexes were 3 to 5 years late. Now, on this Zurich project, I realized that these people were going about this in a completely absurd way. What they were doing was first identifying the chemicals, and then they were going through this laborious process of assigning Geneva systematic nomenclature to the compounds. And it was taking them forever, you know. Besides, they never did have a fire under their ass, so that, you know, they didn't know what it meant to get it out. And they were very nice guys. I almost went to work as a director of research, you know, at Chemical Abstract. I was interviewed for the job.
That was
back in the early 50s. Carl Heumann went to work there. I was interviewed by E.J. Crean and Charles Bernier, the editor. And so we had known each other through the Welch Project. They were amongst the people I knew. I knew all these people. And as a matter of fact, Fred Tate, who became director of research, he was practically, he was out at Wyeth. He and I almost went into business together. He decided to go there rather than here. So I went to Smith Kline and I said to them, listen, I have just figured out, I did a study, that I can produce for you a molecular formula index to the current chemical literature. It will cost you $25,000 a year. Now, God bless him, my dear friend you saw the other day, Glenn Olliott, we didn't talk about it the other day. Glenn Olliott said to these people, you are absolutely out of your mind. He is a chemical abstracts fan from way back, and I don't blame him. In a sense, I should thank him, because when he said I couldn't do it, then it made me madder. Because he just said, well, we can't afford it, okay. But when he said I couldn't do it, and I said, I'll show you. I said, I'm giving you your last chance. You can have an exclusive because I'm your consultant, and I would not do it for anybody else if you want it done. Otherwise, what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask you and 12 other companies to each give me $2,000. And I then called up all the people I got to know through the PMA project. I said, listen, I've been coding these things for a year and a half now. I think I know what it takes to index these compounds, and I will produce for you a molecular formula index. Stretched out, by the time the committee got through with it, they wanted structural diagrams,
you know, you see the first issue, it's quite different than it is today, but it was a hell of a lot different than what I had proposed. On that basis, I said, okay, if you want it that way, you have to agree that I publish this thing, and you each pay $2,000, and anybody else can buy it for $500. And you're committed for 2 years. That's how I got started. Now, the Index Chemicals, believe it or not, it was still going.
And it was, you know, become quite a thing. And in spite of everything that Chem Lab Tracks does, these people still buy it. And they pay $3,000 a year for it now. It's not a very profitable thing at all, as a matter of fact. And it's had its ups and downs, and it led to the story I didn't tell you before when you asked me about people who worked for me. In the early days of Index Chemicals, four of my vice presidents came to me and they said, we think this thing is just going to be a continual drain of money. We'll never make any profit on it. We want to kill it. And I was opposed to it. I said, you know, we'll find ways to make it more efficient, do whatever we have to do, but I don't want to remain on it. It's my, I think it's got a future. They said, okay, either you resign as president, or we're all resigning together. Said, you know, unquotable. Those four vice presidents quit and formed another company. Eventually they went out of business.
Did they stick with the field for the long haul?
They were in the information field, but they never came up with a product that flew. And in one case, they started a product which was so similar to what I was already doing in current content that I sued them. And it fell apart. They didn't get the financing I think they were expecting. Well, one of those people was a guy that came to work for me half time. And I found out about very deceptive behavior that people have. He lied to me until the day he left this company. He said he was not part of the group, and he lied until he got his shares of stock that I had given him an option, but, you know, which eventually he sold out. I bought his shares back years later. So that's one of the trials and tribulations that you have. Not everybody goes along with you, but when the original people that invested in my company from New York came down, they were all, what happened within, 6 months or a year of that? They were in fit. They said to me, you told us that you had this team. How can you manage this whole company by yourself? And I said to them, you know, when I was hiring people like my marketing director, half time, did you ever hear of the Whiz Kids? You know who the Whiz Kids were? McNamara's team? And do you think I was hiring the Whiz Kids? What you have to learn to deal with in American business is how to deal with mediocrity. You don't hire geniuses and keep them very long. Even if you give them equity, which I probably made the mistake of not giving other people equity in the company in the early days, but they did, they had it. So, people want to remain comfortable very quick in the game. They don't want to go on and take the risks. I guess there are times when people have felt that I'm too much of a crap shooter. Sometimes even angry. So, I may have gotten off of the...
No. Well, let me wind back. At what moment were you effectively full time in ISI? What moment did you sort of have the realization that this is this is it. This is my home.
Well, pretty good. I mean, you know, I was working for Smith Kline a couple of days a week for quite a while. I always worked. I had my first three children. I had my son. Then we had three additional children. Subsequently, one of those children died. So my three means Steph and Josh and Laura. I had a very thick schedule. And people who used to work in this company, even then, say to me, they had a lousy relationship with their children. And I knew of people who used to leave here with the excuse of going home. They go home and they didn't spend any time with their kids. It was just an excuse to leave, and they paid no more attention to the kids than the man in the moon. My children knew that I was there for breakfast every morning. I came home Wednesday night. Friday night, I brought home the Chinese food, and I worked on Saturday. But Sunday was absolutely nothing but the kids. So when I was with my children, they knew I was with them. I wasn't anywhere else in my head or anything else. And I think the same thing applies with my son Alexander today. So I was working, 18 hours a day, or whatever it took. Well, what the hell to go over to Smith Kline and schmooze for 6 hours? That was nothing. Do what you have to do. But then I stopped doing consulting. It wasn't very long after that. I forget what the last. I mean, I was already selling them index chemicals. It started in 1960. Ted Erdogan died in 1960 because the first issue was dedicated to him. He was my real boss over there. Not that that was a requirement for me to work there, but he'd been ill for quite a while, and so my relationship on an active basis on it was terminated by then, and with all other clients, essentially. So, and remember, I didn't get my PhD until 61. That was a funny story, by the way, when I did get my PhD, because Zella Karras procrastinated, and he decided to go to Europe and Israel, I think, 1960. And in 1961, I was supposed to get my PhD. So I submitted. So he tells me before he goes that Professor Hish, who may still be, is he still teaching?
Yeah.
I think he retired by now.
Well, at least I see him around.
Yeah, Professor Hish was given the job of being my PhD, monitor or whatever.
One second.
That man's a brilliant logician or something like that, but maybe meant to say something else.
What happened from that, for the next 6 months, he made my life miserable. I submitted my thesis. It was 10 pages. I had proven that you could do what nobody else had ever believed. I mean, I don't think you would demand that of one of your PhD students. The theory, I said to Zoe Harris, if my algorithm doesn't work, I'll do a different topic. Okay. So it was an algorithm that would prove that you could use a computer to convert a chemical name into a molecular formula. Nobody had realized that you could compute them. Everyone had always drawn a structural diagram first and then computed the molecular formula from that. That's
why it took CA so goddamn long to do everything they did, you know. So I proved it. I wrote the thesis up. As a matter of fact, unbeknownst to them, a couple months later, I even submitted a preliminary communication to Nature, which was published. First mechanical translation of chemical nomenclature. It was just a very short item. And I wasn't even sure whether he was, if he found out about it, that he would have used it as prior publication and prevented me from getting my doctorate. So, anyhow, Hish said, oh, this will never do. You cannot have a 10-page dissertation. I then proceeded to write 100-page supplement, which turned out to be a transformational analysis of Geneva nomenclature. Okay? You know, I reprinted it, and it's included in my essay, so if you really want to see it, it's all there. What happened was, I came in with this thing, he would look at it, and he would make some changes in it. Now, in those days, before there were word processors, before they were known to the university, Xeroxes, I would take all his little crappy little changes, this manuscript, go back to my office. I had two secretaries working with me. I had the Xerox machine. He couldn't believe it. I would be back the next day with a completely retyped manuscript. I was using what they call flex writers in those days. Okay? And I had the whole thing on tape. And finally, it got to be absurd, and I said to him, Henry, I don't know the first name or not. This is ridiculous. I said, you aren't going to make a decision. And he admitted to me that Harris had left him holding the bag and nobody was going to make a decision about sending in my recommendation to graduate. I got on the telephone and I called Zelik Harris in Rome. And I don't know if it was true or not, but I assumed that he was there with some lady. And I don't know his personal life all that well, but I said to him, Zelik, I said, you either put a cable in the works tonight, informing them to give me my PhD, or I'm going to come over there in Rome and I'm going to drag you out of bed myself. And I told him about the bargain we had made. It's really screwed me over. There was a cable came 2 days later, and Hönigswald called me over and said, you're going to get your PhD in June. So that's how I got my PhD in 1961. They were going to push me another year.
Yeah.
So that was what I was doing in addition to all the other.
Yeah.
But it was, the thinking was all part of my work. It was a problem for me. I don't know if that was another diversion for you, but
before we move on, I noticed that you filed for a patent in 1958 on a copying and reproducing device, and you got a couple of patents on that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called The Copywriter. There's an article I published in Current Contents about it. Is it a filing in 58 or was it issued in 58?
Well, it was a filing in 58 and then issued in 62.
There were subsequent several patents issued, and most all those are obsolete now. 62 would be obsolete, 79. And you can go out and buy some versions of a copywriter now, There are such things as, and in fact, I was just reading about one that apparently is an OCR version. And there are some other. There may be some applications pending which we could file on if we choose to, but I decided to give up on that.
Well, I had believed from the earliest times that what we needed was what Bernard Clapp called a scholar's camera. The problem with copying machines is that you have to take the document to the machine. My idea was to bring the machine to the document. And I wanted, and the reason the way I got this idea originally was, this is how I met Jack Rabinow, who is America's probably the most prolific inventor. I don't know if he'll ever come into your orbit, but he sure should. He's a fantastic guy. Well, he's an engineer. Because I had wide-ranging interests in information techniques, in New York, during my days at Columbia, I had been involved in a committee of call for sensory devices and aids to the blind, which the Veterans Administration had. And a fellow by the name of Eugene Murphy was the head of that department in New York. He was a marvelous man, an invalid, and I used to go down to these meetings, and they had a contract with RCA. RCA had developed a device which was a reading aid for the blind, and what you did was you scanned the text. And as you scanned the text, this thing would generate an oscillating signal, and it generated like a bird call. Okay? And believe it or not, you could literally learn those signals and translate them into the letters of the alphabet. And some of the blind people that were tested actually could learn to read that way, but it never would work because blind people are extremely sensitive to the idea of losing their hearing. And it does some, you know, constantly listening to those bird calls, they begin to lose a little bit of their high frequency sounds, and so they had to abandon that. But in that device, I saw the opportunity to have a copying machine. Instead of producing a sound, I said, let's take that signal and translate it into a copy. And I literally produced models. I even went down to the VA, and he would let me work there, where we put Teledelto's paper into the circuit. Eventually, I even got a grant for, I think, $5,000 from the Council of Library Resources. We're in a clap. Wanted a thing. And the long and short of this whole thing is that the idea was just too far ahead of the technology. If you want, I could find somewhere in my closet, I've got the original models there in that article that I published in Current Contents. And I visualized, you know, the note-taking. It still is not exactly that way. The one that you can, the Japanese thing that you can buy now, is very cumbersome, and it doesn't quite work the way it should. Eventually it'll solve the problems, but it does make copies. And there's another version now that gives you a typewriter type of output, meaning a platen. And then, but there is one that you can scan this way, and they use it, the Japanese use it to copy. You know, if you have to copy all those kanji characters, that can save a lot of time. So that's how I got into that. And I originally had visualized we could copy structural diagrams with it. You see, that was another motivation. And we still copy diagrams a lot here, but by camera.
Did you try to, aside from these...
Well, we formed a company. It's called, so we still have the corporation, Selective Information Devices. But what I failed to do there was to turn it over to, I tried at various stages to do this, to get a separate company formed, to get a business manager, to get venture capital for it. That's what it needs. And I just, I guess I was never really good enough manager to realize that I had to get people like that to run a thing like that. I couldn't just do it part-time. You know, it just was just another diversion, which
I should have turned over to somebody else. Well, maybe they were lucky because it took, the technology just wasn't there for 20 years. Now you've got all these semiconductors and what have you that make it feasible.
How much of your own time and energy has gone into the sales side of the organization?
A lot. I always think that I have been a consummate salesman. I was always very eager to talk to people about our products and pursued leads. I was a super salesman. That was something that I didn't leave entirely. I still don't. I mean, I still have the temptation to get on the phone and tell somebody about what we got. And I've always wanted to engage in constant dialogue with the customers. And I seem to be able to, in talking to them, even help them figure out what they wanted. And then if there were enough of them said they wanted it, give it to them. Like I did with the drug companies, you know, get 12 of them together. And, you know, look, you can't all have it your way. You got a compromise, we'll give you a product that all of you can use. It's a shared concept. Everybody wants personalized software, but they can't afford it. That's what it's all about. I mean, I got tired of doing the same thing over and over again for the same people. Why not give this product that everybody can use? Well, you still see problems with that today. Everybody, we have custom contents, you know, that's how we got the ASCA SD. We had the first commercial SDI service, still going. It's a vastly underutilized service. Maybe it'll come to its heyday someday. So in a sense, it already has with the online networks, because in reverse, you get SDI, but on the online. I had librarians who couldn't recognize that I had been giving them that service 20 years ago, and I said, oh, we do it online now. They spend a lot more for it online than they do with our service, but that's another thing you find, that the cheapest price is not always the best. You can't deliver the best service. I think that's one of the things that was wrong with that. We shouldn't have made it so cheap. We should have made it better, made it easier in other ways, even included documents. But that's
in the early 60s, you've got current contents, you've got Index Chemicus, and you've got the Genetics Citation Index turning into the Science Citation Index.
Yeah.
As you look over the 25 years approximately from there till now, what are the peaks that stand out? Developing and diversifying.
Well, you got to realize that you may not look at it as a different product, but the decision to publish accumulations is a major risk decision. But it's turned out to be the most important financial decision we ever made. That carried over not only with accumulations that we have done.
More libraries like them?
Well, it just means that additional revenue that we could get, and it improves the utility of it, makes it less cumbersome to use. And then we also went back and did this 1955 to 64. We went back and did back years. I mean, that was unheard of. I'm very proud of that. I mean, it'll be a major tool, I think, for the historian of science. And now we're almost finished with 45 to 54. Who would have thought that anybody would pay $25,000 for that set of books? That's what it had to be, and I knew that it had to be. I mean, I could have taken a bath for it, but somehow, you know, instinctively, I just thought, well, 25 was about it. And there's only going to be a couple hundred libraries that will ever buy it anyhow.
That's what it takes. Same thing with the new. So hopefully all those libraries will continue to go with the thing till we go back to 1900 if we can. And every time you do it, you realize there are projects that people find great use for it. Once it's out, then historians will see and others will see utility for it. I mean, even to this day, we still like to answer the question, who was citing Avery McLeod and McCarthy in those intervening years? Well, I got some preliminary data for people before this index was out, but now I will have answers to things like that. Amazing how many things that are still important today are traceable to that period, post-war years. Well, by the same token, well, how many were pre-war? Yeah. It goes on and on. Never stops.
So you get right the way back to the Royal Society Catalogue of Scientific Literature.
Yeah, I mean, really, every once in a while you see, my God, somebody thought about that in 1870. I mean, I wonder what was going on in those few years. I mean, when you think the way I do in citation terms, you've got to have that index for every year where there's a possible citation. The trouble is that I think that as you get back to the 1900s, the citation practices really got sloppy, so you've got to do real textual analysis. And the journals didn't have the formalized citations, so you got to do what we do now with social science stuff. And there's, no, we haven't gone back to the early period yet to the social science. We've got 66 onward. We're producing 56 to 66 now. And the arts and humanities, I don't know when we'll ever go back and do that. Because they're the place where you really could use it, they can least afford it.
Yeah.
We're lucky if we get them to buy it now, currently.
Well, one day that might be something NEH, one day, might.
We sure have a facility for doing it in Ireland now.
Yeah.
And I hope that we can, if we cost it out, figure out that it would be something that a typical customer could afford. I don't know. It's a very labor-intensive work.
Yeah. I should think NEH might really be interested in that prompt. In due course, when the science.
If somebody like you suggested it, maybe. You see, I've always had that conflict of interest. When I go to these foundations, I have to interpret what I want as being, you know, self-interest, and in a certain sense it is. And, I mean, somebody else may be able to come up with a deal. I would gladly do those back things for them at a cost plus, you know, I mean, I wouldn't just to get it done, but.
I think when the science one is further along, it'd be appropriate to say, since we need it more.
How further along, I don't know. But, well, I think the compact disc will change things a lot, because there'll be a lot of pressure on us to put that on a compact disc. I think you could put that whole darn thing on two discs, right? And that makes it so much more accessible to so many more people. And I think the individual professor in the humanities could conceivably have the arts and humanities right in his own desk. I mean, that's the way you should have it. No, it's like having the OED. These tools should be the scholar's tools, and that was my ultimate hope.
What's changed about your own work as ISI has grown?
Well, I used to be far more heavily involved in day-to-day work, day-to-day things than I am now. Over the years, I have let my interest in writing take over a lot of my time, although I developed a particular editorial team and style that makes it, you know, fairly efficient. Trained a lot of good writers who left me. Similar thing with the newspaper, but I've feel far more removed from things than I used to. You just can't. Recently had a very sad experience with bringing in a chief operating officer who just did not understand the business and had some other problems. And so that would have, if it had worked out right, would have given me more time to devote to R&D and editorial. That's basically where I'm interested. New product development. There's so many things that could be done with this database that just haven't been done. So that doesn't mean that they would be profitable, but useful. And a lot of people who are willing to pay for it on a cost basis can get a lot of interesting stuff out of it as well. But I think it's a tragedy that, you know, I did the study of 1,000 most cited authors. I did that as an editorial project. It cost us unbelievable amount. We spent over $100,000 to do that article, that series. I can't get a grant to do these things easily. There's the data. I would gladly do that study. I've been waiting 3 years to do just a follow-up for the 400 new names. I've got the names, but I just can't afford the cost of untangling all the, you know, because I don't want to do wrong data. Now, untangling the homographs is the big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought of setting up some kind of a non-profit foundation that might do that. But again, that takes time too,
mm-hmm.
and energy.
Yeah.
So, you got to be able to hire somebody to do that, right? Apply for the grants, which is something we should have paid more attention to. But we've had ups and downs. I guess I've had a lot of people come and go here who are not necessarily as loyal to ISI as I might have expected. And maybe I was unreasonably expecting them to stick with it, but, you know, a lot of other people are using our data for all kinds of purposes. If we can, I'd like to see this International Science Indicators project get off the ground, but it's just taken a long time to.
Let me take you over to the scientist for a minute or two, because like so many other things you've done, the germ of it goes way back.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, will you be in Worcester, Mass?
I'm hoping to make an appearance, yeah.
On Thursday, is it?
Thursday,
yeah,
Friday.
Thursday 7. Evening. I will be reading from letters by Derek Price.
In that
session.
Okay.
I've got one of the letters right here that I'm going to be reading about. The fact is that the newspaper idea is goes back so far that it includes a proposal that I made to the National Science Foundation, which I actually forgot about, a formal proposal to publish a citation index in a newspaper format. And Derek refers to that in one of his letters. In his letter of March 8, 1963, he says, "Dear Gene, as regards the science newspaper, I see we have rather different ideas. My own notion is for something that looks very much like the Wall Street Journal, but substituting bibliographic indexes for the stock market prices, and having a page for each of the chief sciences written in the style of fairly meaty reviews, with the addition of a more newsy column for the experts in other fields, and of course with the front page of the daily devoted to the main social political news and gory details of all the breakthroughs. If you have not done so, just sent a copy of your proposal to Anthony Michaelis. It goes back quite a ways. What's missing here is a copy of my proposal. I thought I asked for a copy of that. That's not here. I'll have to get it out. But what else can I tell you about the newspaper in Torrey? The story about it is told in a condensed form in the last year, that article I did in the current contents.
I think we really want to conclude this interview, this history, not by concluding, because the history is only in the middle, but by, in a way, probably asking you to take a little bit of a look forward. What do you think your own preoccupations are going to be in the next several years?
Well, you may have heard from other people, when an organization gets apparently beyond the magic number of about 400 or 500 people, it takes on a different kind of life. It takes a different kind of management to run it. And I think that one way or another, ISI will have to get linked in with probably more capital, more technology, people with vast resources, like, you know, we're dealing with satellite communications, all sorts of things, and I think that unless we're extremely lucky, it'll be difficult to finance all of these new technological developments. I mean, it's cost us a great deal to do the CD-ROM. Either we'd have to go back and become a small company, so to speak, that stagnates or hangs on for the rest of my life, or it becomes really significantly big. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if by one series of transformations or another, this went from a $40 million to a $100 million company in 5 years or something like that. Where that leaves me, it's not clear, but one way or the other, I'm sure I'll have a role in it, but and I hope it'll, you know, I'll be still involved in the idea stage and the editorial. I don't want to be. I mean, the newspaper has to have a kind of integrity that I want on it, and if it changes, it has to change. That become like a yellow dog kind of a thing. I just soon get rid of it. It's not easy to. I never thought it'd be so difficult to work with people in getting an editorial product that does satisfy your desires without you having to sit and manage it every minute. So, as a publisher, it's a different kind of role for me, and it's something I have to decide how much time I'm going to give to that, and I have to sacrifice other things to do it. You know, some people would, I could just spend all my time devoted to current contents, and it would be by its own universe, and it would improve in many ways that I haven't had time to spend on it. Monies that we spent on other things could have gone into making it much better. But then I had the fun of doing the other things. SCI has got all kinds of dimensions to it that need to be expanded. I hope that Chemical Abstracts and the others will, you know, it ought to be up on their network. I wanted to do the Chemistry Citation Index. I mean, the whole thing ought not to be separated. How you get all these organizations together is hard, but eventually it has to happen. But even the index chemicals, I don't know. As they get better, does it become redundant? It's funny that drug companies still think it's necessary, but in a certain sense, conceptually, it's odd that CA still hasn't been able to do what is necessary. Maybe we could just join it together. I don't know. So I think I don't want to spend, I don't really want to spend much of my, the rest of my time doing things that are not really necessary that other people can do just as well. The Atlas of Science is, of course, the next big project that I think, as a matter of fact, when we started it, it's the harbinger of things to come. It has almost infinite possibilities. And we're only planning 12 sections right now, but I mean, it could easily be 100.
Is it still going? Come closer. With some interim retrospect, it seems as if you had an almost ideal education for what you turned out to do. But what would you do differently about that background if you were doing it over?
You mean my educational background?
Well, you've got them. If you go all the way right through to the PhD.
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, if people had let me go on the course that I had originally tried to do, I would have stayed at Hopkins. Dr. Larkey would have kept me on, and I would have got my PhD in the history of science. I started out there. I took courses at Hopkins, and I was fascinated by the history of science. And, maybe I was inherently basically an engineer all along. I mean, the fact that I went into engineering in the beginning, build a better mousetrap, that was in me, maybe. I've made some contributions to the theory of my field, but I don't think of myself as a theoretician that much. As a matter of fact, it made me think about, I once did an invention called radio retrieval, which I think you would eventually see as the antecedent of parallel processors. And some other time I can tell you about it. There was a case where I didn't have enough. It was so outrageous an idea that I was afraid to tell anybody about it, so to speak. Turns out to be fantastic field, right? Parallel processing. So I guess about the education thing, it's hard for me to say. I sort of like teaching. I did teach at Penn regularly for a few years, but I didn't have enough time to do it right because I always felt a little ashamed in front of the students. I always thought that they were looking at me like I was like covering up my gaps in my knowledge or something. I don't know, it was a strange feeling. And I don't know how teachers get over that these days, because every day goes by, they're more and more obsolete. But I guess you have to learn to pull it off. I mean, it's just an approach. Or maybe it was the kind of people I was getting there. I wanted to teach at the Edinburgh School, and George Gerbner, bless his soul, who I see regularly now, he wanted me to submit a proposal over there to do a program in scientific communication and retrieval. Which, I mean, how could I possibly have done that in the time that I had available? I was offered the deanship at Drexel years ago. Can you believe the guy wanted me to leave my company? And I told him, I said, one of the best, most respected people I know is a chairman of a department at Stanford and is vice president of research at Syntex, and that was Carl Jurassic. So I said, isn't it good enough for you that I'm willing to take on the assignment of being the dean of the goddamn school? You want me to give up my company? That'd be crazy. So, never happened. But I think that a lot of people underestimate what you can do. And I might not have done the other as well, that's all. The limit, everybody has his limitations.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do, Gene. We're
then come back in 25 years to check what you've done at the next stage.
Yeah, well, there was a time when I thought that we would have a way to delay the aging process.
No, you'll just be Arnold Beckman's age in 25 years.
Is that his age now?
He's going...
How old is he?
Strong. We got that.
He's 88?
87. 87.
Wow.
Going on 88.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic.
And
are you going to be at the Franklin Institute?
Yeah.
Thinking hard about trying to get there. So, yeah, well, that's a very nice thought. I appreciate that thought. I'd be very happy to confirm that.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bet. Okay.
Sure. That's a very, very pleasant way to end the day. I'll tell that to my wife. That's exactly.
Thank you.
Okay.